Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to Magical Musings, a 2-hour show with Ryan and Joy, and we're going to be doing Wicca tonight. And this is our 7th show, so we're going to be doing that in addition to everything. So if you want to pay attention and ask questions, please feel free to jump in the chat room and let us know. So, all right, here we go. Like I said, tonight's show is going to be on Wicca and some of the more advanced thoughts on Wicca. It's not going to be the same basic 101 stuff that you can find in all the books and stuff, although we are going to touch on some of that to a bit, simply to make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about. Let me see. I have to tell you, this is the third time that Brian and I have done this show. We've tried recording it twice so that we could do a couple of other things and just broadcast it into the ethers for you guys later, but technical difficulties, technology apparently does not like us today.
Yes.
Or this, I don't know why, it's failed twice, so we're doing it live. We put this off on from our normal Thursday night broadcast to Saturday, so if you're around, don't be shy. Give us a holler. Okay, so first things first, what is Wicca? Wicca is an initiatory, oath-bound tradition of paganism that venerates a god and a goddess. It is very concerned with the fertility of not only the earth, but the people around and the practitioners. After all, when you talk about fertility, you're talking about the continuation of not only the tribe through birth and death, but also the herds which support the tribe and the crops that are grown to feed the tribe as well. So it's in the original sense, that's what Wicca was developed to be, okay? And because this is an earth-based religion, because it is developed along principles that you would find normally, say, in a medieval setting or in prehistory, where there's very clear definitions between the sexes, and hunter-gatherers type society, many, many, many people seem to think that this is an ancient religion that came from prehistory. And I'm going to be the very first one to tell you it isn't, okay? Wicca was developed by a gentleman by the name of Gerald Gardner back in the early 1950s, okay? This is the first mention of Wicca at all. He had a book called High Magic's Aid, which was a fictional work postulating that there were witches that were still running around and part of society and what they would be like, and pretty much laid out Wicca as he wound up developing it. He came out later with a longer version that was supposed to be the working book that described everything, okay? When he did this, supposedly, all these other covens in the area came out and started interacting with him and saying, yeah, we're Wiccan covens. We've been around forever, and this is exactly what we're like. There's very little evidence other than anecdotal evidence that that actually happened. One of the groups that supposedly came out was a coven that had the leader by the name of Lady Jessie Bell. And the rituals that she put out in her book, saying that this is what she was taught and what was taught by others and passed down to her, are almost identical to Gardner's rituals. Well, the big problem there is that Gardner rewrote his rituals multiple times. Okay, and coming into a short history of Wicca and how it developed, supposedly in 1953 or so, Gardner was initiated into the New Forest Coven in England and learned Wicca from that. In actual fact, what can be proven is that he took quite a number of pieces and elements of ritual from the Golden Dawn and the OTO, which is known as the Ordu Templis Orientis, and that's a spinoff of the Golden Dawn itself. Okay, the OTO was run by Aleister Crowley. The rituals were written and cribbed from a lot of other sources, among them some of the King Solomon, the Keys of the King Solomon. And those pieces of ritual were put together and made into the rituals for the OTO. Well, the original rituals for Wicca were almost identical. And through documented history and such, apparently Gardner was, anointed by Aleister Crowley to bring the OTO to that area of England at the time. As far as we can tell, he didn't, although he might have started a group up there, I don't know, but took a lot of the information and started Wicca, okay, with those rituals and with that information and with that how to do things, okay. It grew and it spread throughout England. He had a high priestess by the name of Doreen Valente, who took the original rituals that Gardner came up with and rewrote them so that they were a lot more beautiful and a lot more immediate. Instead of saying some of the mystic phrases like echo, echo, evo, evo, that are in the OTO and in some of the high magic, she actually made it poetic. The charge of the goddess, some of the other additions to it. Now, here's the problem. Because Wicca, when it started, was Gardnerian Wicca, and we'll get into the different versions of Wicca in a bit, and it's because it's in an oath-bound tradition, the practitioners are sworn to secrecy, okay? They are initiated, and there's a ritual where during the initiation, information is taken from them, like their name, their measurements, and a few other things, and a piece of them, and it's put into a bundle that's kept by the high priestess so that if this person ever breaks their oath, they can use it to punish the person infringing that. The what this leads to is that we don't know exactly what the rituals are. We have copies of the rituals that were released by a gentleman by the name of Aidan Kelly, who apparently joined Wicca, Gardnerian Wicca, specifically to do this. He went in, copied all the, went through the rituals, got initiated, copied out all the rituals and the information and everything, and then published them. What this means is that he broke his oaths to do this. So while we have copies of the rituals, we don't know if they're what's actually practiced. Okay. And I've asked Gardnerian Wiccans if this is what's going on. They're not talking. And the people who are talking don't know. So we've got the Gardnerian Book of Shadows, but we can't verify from anybody that it's actually the accurate Book of Shadows that people use now. There's also three different versions of the same Book of Shadows, because when Gardner was developing Wicca, he wound up writing the rituals and mailing them out to people that were in the groups and asking their opinions, getting the information back from them, rewriting the rituals, coming up with additional things, things that needed to be added or changed or whatever, typos, grammar, things like that, and then mailing those back out. And so there's three complete sets of Gardnerian Book of Shadow rituals due to this. One does have Doreen's stamp on it, and I think it's, you know, better in my opinion. From that, you started having some spinoff groups, and like Catholicism, was Christianity at the time, because it was the only Christian group out there. You didn't have to say it was Catholic, because everybody knew it just as Christianity. Wicca sort of developed the same way. It started out with Gardnerian Wicca, and that's just Wicca. And there are a number of very hot debates saying that the only Wiccans there are those that are initiated into Gardnerian Wicca. I'm not going to get into that one. That's, you know, between the practitioners themselves to figure out. Personally, I figure if you're going to do any spinoff of Wicca, of Gardnerian Wicca, then you're Wiccan yourself. So anyhow, Alexandrian came from the gentleman who started this, and I'm drawing a blank on his name, even though I know
Alex
it.
Sanders?
Well, it's Alex Sanders, yes. Alexandrian Wicca was started by him, and he had objected to some of the rituals in Wicca, very similar to how Martin Luther got upset with the Catholic Church and nailed his 57 theses to their church door. Alex Sanders did pretty much the same thing, and came up with his own version of Wicca using nearly identical rituals to what Gardner had, and started initiating people into it. One of the things that Alex Sanders objected to was the oath-bound nature of Wicca, and the what's called taking the measure, which is when they, you know, get the measurements and everything and are going to use that to punish you if you break your oaths. He objected to that. He didn't like it. So in Alexandrian Wicca, while they still take the measure, they give it back to the initiate right then, so that they're not, you know, holding this sword of Damocles over their head and making them obey through fear. Alexandrian Wicca started right around somewhere in the mid-60s, I believe. The most famous initiates of that tradition are
Stuart and Janet Farrar?
Yes, Janet and Stuart Farrar. Understand something, folks. I'm doing this from memory. and, yes, it is Janet and Stuart Farrar, and then Gavin Bone was who I was thinking of. And there in England, they've published several books, amongst them The Real Witch's Bible. And that's pretty much Alexandrian Wicca encapsulated in something that you can hold in your hand. Now, I have spoken to Alexandrian practitioners, and while they will tell me, yes, the material in the book is accurate, they also say that it is not all the material. It is like 98% of it. But there are certain rituals and certain items that are not passed on unless you're initiated in the circle, and they're not written down. So these mysteries, you know, are only given if you're an initiated, lineaged Alexandrian witch, okay? Along comes mid-70s, along comes Raymond Buckland, a gentleman who was living in England at the time and decided that he was going to study Wicca with Gardner. He's an initiated Gardnerian Wiccan. He studied with one of the priestesses that Gardner had in his coven, but it wasn't Doreen Volente, because part of Gardnerian beliefs is that you have three phases of life in the female cycle. You have the maiden, where you're, you know, a young child, prepubescent sometimes, virginal, and still a child. Then you have the mother phase, where you're nubile, you can give birth to children, and that lasts until you're like mid-40s when you go through menopause. After that, you have the crone phase, which is the old wise lady who sits there and pokes you with a stick and makes you do things you don't want to, but you love them anyway. the high priestesses of Gardnerian covens are supposed to be in the mother phase. They're supposed to be young. They're supposed to be beautiful. They're supposed to be nubile. They're supposed to be fertile, okay, and able to have children. Well, as priestesses, you know, age and get older, eventually they get shunted off to the crone phase, and a new priestess who's young and nubile and beautiful is initiated as the priestess. Doreen had been retired for a couple of years as the priestess, and Raymond was studying with her replacement. According to him, he never studied with Gardner himself, but the material was coming pretty much as straight from Gardner as it's possible to get. His job was to become a third-degree initiate of Gardnerian Wicca, come over to America, and start spreading Gardnerian Wicca in the United States. He did that. He learned it. He studied it. He got his third-degree initiation, came over to the United States, started spreading it out in New York, I believe. He started a couple covens up there. and then had a crisis of conscience and left Gardnerian Wicca. Now, what wound up happening from there is that he still believed a lot of the Wiccan attitudes and a lot of the Wiccan things, and he still wanted to practice Wicca. It's just he didn't agree with how the how it was being presented in Gardnerian Wicca. So because it's also a degreed an oath-bound tradition, he didn't want to break those oaths, so he came up with his own tradition of Wicca called Sax Wicca. It's Saxon-based. It uses some of the same deities. It uses some of the same structure, but uses specifically Saxon deities that you can find in the landscape in the area in England. Okay, so that's the short history. The Wicca is a duotheistic religion, which means that it is a god and a goddess, okay? And it tends to be, a few episodes back we were talking about deities and how it's split out into there's one level where it's the yin and yang principle, where it's the male deity that encompasses all things that are male, including the nurturing kind type, and then there's the female deity that encompasses everything that is female, including the warrior destroyer type. That's what, to our understanding, Wicca is supposed to be worshiping. That's the level of deity that we're talking about. So you have a god and you have a goddess, and a lot of times they don't have a name because they're just... I mean, it's kind of hard to reconcile and to get your brain around having a deity of kindness and a goddess of kindness and love who is gentle and sweet and wonderful, but also whose dance can destroy the world like Kali does, or who eats their children like the white sow in Serweden does, or who denies their own children like Eddie Anfrod does. So... You kind of don't put a name on it. It's just the Lord and the Lady. But it is very duotheistic. It does have magic and spellcraft in it. They're focused prayers more than anything else. And the spells tend to be more along the lines of asking the deities for favors and returning to them your energy and your labors in honor of them. The cycle of the year, the ritual structure for it is a solar and a lunar cycle. Okay, because the goddess, I don't know if this was set up this way, but one of the things that I've noticed is that the goddess tends to be more preeminent in Wicca than the god is. And I think this is a reaction to all the male deities that's forced down everybody's throat in Christianity. Because in Christianity, you have one male god. He's the only judge. You don't hear about the female at all. Well, in opposition to this, you have Wicca, which has a preeminent female deity, and the male deities tend to serve the female deities, okay? Some of the rituals in Alexandrian has the high priest being the priestess's servant, giving her his authority. She gets to sit on the altar, he doesn't. Various things like that. But anyway, and that comes from the fact that the goddess is associated with the moon, and the moon is much closer and it's much more there than the sun is. The sun is further away, and it's hot. from this, what you wind up getting is you get eight solar Sabbaths, which are, let's see, you have the solstices and you have the equinoxes, and then you have Samhain and Imbolc, and then Beltane, and then Lusnada as the cycle of seasons. And those are big celebrations. And then you have 13 Esbits, which are the working portions of the, not the celebrations, but the get-togethers. They're the Sunday meetings where you get together and you have the sermons and you talk about things and you do spells and you do rituals for healing and you learn how to make this, that, and the other from the priest and priestess. Some groups go far enough that they add in the new moon rituals. So you have once every 2 weeks, and you have 26 meetings throughout the year, okay? And this is because the moon is a lot closer, and it has a lot more influence on us. I mean, the sun warms us, and it does give us the change in the weathers, but the moon, you know, affects the tides. The sun doesn't. There's pulls in us. There's a lunar connection in ourselves. There's a certain type of clam that opens only during the full moon. And when it was taken out of the ocean and moved way inland, it took a month to adjust to its new location, and it was still opening during the full moon. You know, so there's that. Plus, there's also the female cycle, her periods, menstrual cycle. And that's, you know, seen as sacred and holy because, once again, the fertility and the having the children. Let me take a drink here for a second. Okay.
And
what?
And one of the things kind of that I do want to mention about the eight festivals is that while there's some basis in ancient traditions as far as those non-equinox and solstice festivals, they are, like, they were kind of compiled and put together by Gerald Gardner and Ross Nichols back in, like, the late 40s kind of thing, as kind of a structured format for what was basically emerging as neo-paganism.
Right. And that's one of the big questions that I always had was, okay, you've got the observable astronomical phenomena of the solstices and equinoxes, okay? Where did they get Beltane and all the rest of them, and why did they put them in those areas? And the best that anybody can really come up with is they needed a celebration that was midway between one of the equinoxes and one of the solstices. Because if you look at the Wheel of the Year, and you set it up so that Yule is at the top, and it's a nice circle going clockwise. You've got an equinox, a fire festival, a solstice, a fire festival, an equinox, a fire festival, a solstice, and a fire festival. Okay, and the fire festivals are the Beltane and those, and Samhain and such. But you've got a start period of a time, which is the equinox or the solstice. And then midway between that, you've got this major festival for the deity of that time period. You don't really have an astronomical marker for that like you do the solstices and equinoxes. And so it kind of always was, you know, I don't understand why they put it there, but, you know, that's become the tradition, and it's even carried over into the Gregorian calendar with things like Imbolc is on January the 31st. That's typically when it's put. But you have Groundhog Day 2 days later, and when you actually look at the celebration of Groundhog Day, It's almost exactly the same as what was what embolic is at that time. It's a time of divination for the year, figuring out whether winter's going to continue and you still have to, you know, preserve everything. It's a festival of light, and then you have the tradition of the groundhog with, if he sees his shadow, more winter. If not, then winter's going to be over soon. And the same with Beltane, which hits right near Easter. It's a celebration of fertility. I mean, you've got bunny rabbits and you've got eggs and, you know, you've got the crops starting to grow and everything. And spring has already started with the spring equinox. And this is a celebration midway between the spring equinox and the summer solstice, where it's, you know, big fertility and everything's growing and we're all happy and everything's grand. So that was one of the questions that I always had about it, and I've never really found a good answer. So that's something that, you know, can be researched out and try to find out why that's there.
Well, I would imagine that just as a kind of way to fill time, sort of something to look forward to in the course of the year, because otherwise, if all you're celebrating is the solstices and equinoxes just because they are natural, they exist, and they are uncontrollable from a human perspective, I mean, that's a long wait, you know, between them, right? And heck, you know, you want to give people something to look forward to, you know, not just to, like, space out holidays. Because people are going to be like, you know what, this belief system sucks so bad. We only celebrate the solstices and equinoxes. They're months apart. And, you know, when you want to get all fertile and, you know, sexual for Eöster, it's a long time until the summer solstice. So, you know, May Day, you know, give it a whole bunch of symbolism and make it another, you know, fertility oriented day. And I mean, you look all over Europe especially, and you've got different traditions that relate specifically to Beltane, you know, May Day, etc. Walpurgisnacht is the night before, and you know, that's like a huge witches' night in like the German countries, because that's the night that witches were said to fly to, I can't remember the name of the mountain, but a certain mountain in like Germany or, you know, thereabouts, that was kind of the main meeting point for witches to have their great sabbat.
Right, and it is, you know, a way of I guess killing time would be a good thing, and there's, it makes me question that here you have all of these folk rituals that are part of the landscape and part of the tradition in Europe, and you know, where did they come from? And it comes to with Wicca, at least, it becomes a chicken and the egg thing. Did the rituals in Wicca come from these, or did these folk traditions come from some other ancient celebration similar to Beltane and Samhain? And so it's one of those things that, you know, you start questioning after a little while, and you start trying to look at. And while we're on the subject of the ancientness of Wicca, here I want to get this information out there. Wicca is not ancient, okay? That does not make it invalid. That does not change its worth. It just means that it's not from how Neolithic man decided to celebrate. Okay, you're going to have a lot of people out there that try to tell you that it is ancient, and there's several books that try to say that it's ancient. But in actual fact, there's very little evidence of any kind that it is. There are elements in Wicca which were put there deliberately that have ancient origins. For example, while Gardner was developing Wicca, one of the things that he wanted to do was get a lot of the folk traditions added into Wicca so that he could say, see, this is an ancient practice. It's got all these folk traditions in it. And so he went out and deliberately found the people called the cunning men and women who had the knowledge of the herbs and the midwifery and the how to look at the cycles of the seasons and understand what was happening and find the old ladies who, you know, still pick their herbs by the moonlight, reaching through their left-hand sleeve with their right hand to pluck the herb correctly, and the energy healing and things like that. To try to give, I guess, a patina of legitimacy and ancientness to this new tradition. So the people that were added in who had this knowledge, not the original witches, okay, they had information that was passed down to them by their parents and their grandparents and everything to tell them how to do this. But just because that one element is ancient or comes from olden times does not mean the whole thing does. Because by that measure, Christianity goes back to the beginning of Zoroastrianism. Because that's an element of Christianity, but that's not the whole thing, okay? So when people say that how we're worshiping right now in Wicca is how they worshipped in the Indus province in India in 10,000 BCE, the Indus Valley. You know, look at them, kind of nod your head and go, oh, okay, and then back away slowly and then go someplace else. Because it's just not true. Like I said, the elements are there. It's supposed to look old, but it's simply not. I mean, when you can trace the origins of the at least the spoken parts of the rituals back to contemporary sources, you can't say the whole thing's ancient anymore.
Well, and I think, too, that part of that comes from the feeder traditions that led into Wicca, like the Theosophists and, you know, the ceremonial magic from, like, the Middle Ages and that sort of thing. All of these sort of came from traditions that required that claim of ancientness to render it valid. Like, you get the same thing in certain traditions of Wicca, but you get it in a lot of the esoteric societies as well. The idea that,
you know, the Rosicrucians and the Masons and
there's like that requirement of ancientness to claim legitimacy. You'll hear it in a lot of different TV documentaries about this, that, or the other sort of esoteric theme as well. You'll get claims that these date back to, you know, Atlantis, when the Druids were the priests of Atlantis, and, you know, etc. And all of this is just kind of made up stuff cobbled together in like the 18th or 19th centuries based on whimsy, flights of fantasy.
Yeah, some of it's whimsy. Some of it is starting with a premise and trying to prove it and finding facts that prove the premise, ignoring everything that disproves it. Like Margaret Murray came out with her famous essays essentially saying that witchcraft has been around since Neolithic times, and that there were covens that had, you know, that were in existence at the time, who had were practicing, you know, the way their great, great, great to the fifth power ancestors were practicing. And the evidence was overwhelmingly against this. But she came out with this document, and then a lot of people had to prove it, and that's suspected as to why one of the reasons that Wicca was developed, one of the reasons Gardner developed Wicca, because he was a hobbyist anthropologist and was trying to prove her essays correct. And I don't know, I mean, you play the game of telephone where you say something to one person and it goes around the room for 30, 40 people, and when it gets back to the original person, it's absolutely nothing like what they said in the beginning. You can't have a completely oral tradition being passed down parent to child without some changes happening. And people claiming that it's exactly the same, right down to the misspellings in the Books of Shadows, that they had, you know, centuries ago, eons ago. It's just, no, there's no way. I mean, it's just observable fact shows that. What, Mary?
Well, and I think the same thing happens in, like, Dianic witchcraft as well, you know, with that claim of provable goddess monotheism and, you know, certain practices that are, you know, still practiced exactly the same way as they would have been millennia ago, etc. And I think it all comes from the same need to claim that ancient heritage to validate somehow the tradition so that you feel like it's valid because it's old.
Well, I don't, you know, and I'm not down on somebody, you know, wanting to feel like it's an ancient practice. That's fine. It's not, you know, it's when you claim with absolute authority that this is what it was. And going through UPG, doing readings, doing divinations, and trying to figure out what it was in the past, that's great and that's fine. And if that's, you know, central to your practice, like it is with some traditions of Wicca, go for it. But don't claim with 100% certainty that this is what they did unless you have reams of fact to back it up. I mean, just say, okay, this is inspired by the goddess, and this is what she told me was happening. And everybody will go, oh, okay, and accept it, and they'll move on. But when you start saying this is absolutely the way it was, then you're going to have a lot of people trying to disprove it or trying to prove it, and you're going to have a lot of conflict and a lot of unnecessary drama. Mary pointed out that if you take a sentence and you translate it into another language and then translate it into a third language and then translate that same sentence back to the original language, it looks absolutely nothing like it's supposed to. And
that's true.
You can go
the
to
influences
Google
of grammar.
Translate
and
for that. Mm-hmm. It's,
yeah,
it's a mind map. It's how, you know, the language is based on, and religion as a language of symbols is based on how you see the universe as a child and how your culture sees the universe. And when you translate something from another culture into your culture, it all changes. The landscape of the religion changes. But anyway, that's the ancientness of Wicca. It's one of those things that there are proponents and opponents on both sides of it. Me personally, it's Wicca is not ancient. It never was ancient. There are elements that have ancientness in it, and that's fine. you know, just whatever you want to believe, not my kink, and go on.
Well, I mean, the same can be said of any religion. There are elements of ancientness in Christianity, even though, you know, they're not, like, legit if you read everything in the literalist mindset. Like,
right.
There's
yeah.
the savior deities that existed prior to, and Justin Martyr said, well, no, the devil laid those, you know, in advance. Well, okay, it doesn't invalidate them. It's just the way things are, you know, whatever.
It's, you also have one of the terms that I wanted to talk about in Wicca, that when you start getting involved with Wicca and start getting around Wiccans, that is confusing for a lot of people, is the term inner court and outer court. Wicca is structured on circles. Okay, there's a coven of 13 people, high priest, high priestess, and 11 other people in the actual coven. Coven is short for covenant, so that you know that. The circle is the actual worship area. Okay, because you want to become a Wiccan does not mean you automatically get entrance into the circle. There is a training period that you have to go through so that you understand the structure of Wicca, where it came from, their specific beliefs in this group, and things like that. And that is done during the outer court phase. Okay, it's usually, the training is usually a year and a day. The people go to great lengths to tutor you and to have classes and to have assignments, and you meditate and do prayers, and you get your own rituals that you perform at your house on your own, so that you get familiar with the structure of that group's Wicca. And that training group usually 2, 3, sometimes 10, upwards to 20 people at a time is called the outer court, okay? When you actually get initiated into the coven itself and you take your oaths and you go through the process of being reborn, that is when you move into the inner court teachings, okay? It's not people thinking that they're royalty. It's just a way to differentiate between what it's okay to teach publicly and what is closely held as a secret to amongst the Wiccan group itself, okay? So keep that in mind when y'all start getting involved in Wicca and start talking to Wiccans. While we're talking about the initiation, we're going to talk, or I'm going to talk really quickly about the self-dedication and the group initiation, and this is pulling an element that's supposed to come way later in the show into now, but I wanted, since we touched on it, you have some Wiccans who don't have a group that they're part of, and they're called solitary Wiccans. They do their worship services on their own without a high priest and priestess. And one of the things that they is kicked about in Wiccan circles is that you can't dedicate yourself as a Wiccan without somebody else doing it for you. And it's kind of six of one, half dozen of the other. You can, but in some ways you can't also. And that sounds confusing, but there's actually a logical reason for it. Dedication is just making a decision that you want to be part of this group and that you want to serve these deities and that you want to do all of this and worship in this way. The teachings come later, but you can't initiate yourself into Wicca. And the reason being is initiation is something that is done to you by somebody else as a way of introducing you to not only the deities, but also to the practitioners, Okay, I can't recline here because when I do, I stop being able to think. Way of introducing you to the other members, to the whole of the practitioners. It's kind of like an all-access pass to the club. So initiation gives you that pass. The dedication does not. So you can say, yes, I'm a dedicated Wiccan. I've gone through my dedication. I've talked to the deities. They're teaching me the stuff. But you would still have to go through an initiation into the group rather than going through it by yourself. The rest of the solitary versus coven we'll talk about in a little while. Okay, let's see. Focus on the god and goddess as the yin and yang principle. We kind of talked about this with the deities show that we did. The focusing on a god and goddess that is not named and relating them to all of male deities and all female deities is okay, but it's really, really hard to do when you get into actual practice. A lot of groups wind up having their own deity names, and those deities are specific to their group, and they, you know, tend to not share those names because they are sacred. And they, let me see.
Well, and I mean,
trying to organize my thoughts here for a second.
I think part of the difficulty too with the idea of having a duotheistic system, wherein all gods are one god and all goddesses are one goddess, is that there can tend to be conflicts because depending on the names you're using, there are hard polytheists who, you know, recognize that all gods are standalone deities in and of themselves. They tend to dismiss the idea that they can all be lumped into one, you know, male and one female deity, primarily because they have
a mosh pit.
Well, exactly. I mean, they have different personalities, different lore, different associations, and so on. So you will have conflict, especially if, say, it might even be touched on when we do our Ausatru show, but like hardcore Ausatruar tend to dislike the idea that Wiccans mush up, you know, their pantheon into the duotheistic system, because according to the lore that we have, you can see different personalities and different, you know, kind of storylines for each deity. So mushing them into one umbrella is kind of, in their eyes, disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those, this is one of the also big questions in Wiccan circles, and it's a source of real conflict between general pagans and Wiccans in specific, because that lumping everybody into the divine mosh pit is disrespectful, and it discounts the cultural differences, and it equates deities that are traditionally enemies with each other. I mean, when you have Mars, who's a Roman god of war, and then you have the female god of war, you know, and they're both gods of war, but, you know, in Celtic mythology, the Morrigan was, you know, attacked and being destroyed by the Romans and their Roman god, you know, and so while it's possible that they could get together and, you know, be good buddies, it's probably not going to happen unless you've got really, really good priestesses and priests to be able to channel it into, you know, the brotherhood of combat rather than the assault of an enemy. And that's, you know, something that's not generally taught It's something that you have to learn by, you know, having it blow up. Okay, in this part, what we're going to talk about for the next hour or so is some of what Wicca is not. Okay, I would say one of the biggest debates amongst Wiccans themselves is whether or not all witches are Wiccan, and whether all Wiccans have to be witches. Okay, there's a school of thought that says yes, Wicca equals witchcraft, and then there's the group that says it doesn't, and I fall very solidly into the side that says it doesn't. Wicca is a religion. It is a way of worshiping divine entities. It is a way of asking for their blessings. It is a celebration of the cycles of nature and of them. Witchcraft is a craft. It is a skill set of the witch. The divination, the interpretation of the divination, the tools for divination, the harvesting of the herbs, the compounding, the medicines from those herbs, the being able
spells.
To work with animals, the spells are part of it, the using the cycles of nature to your advantage, all of that is a skill that is learned and practiced. And you don't practice doing a celebration for Beltanya. You don't practice sex, but you practice extracting essential oils from the lavender to sell. And that's, you know, it is a craft. It's a skill set. I like to refer to it, or like to equate it to, Jesus was a carpenter. That does not mean all Christians are carpenters, because carpentry is a skill set. Christianity is a religion. But to put the Wiccan argument into those terms, all Christians are carpenters because the founder had the skill set of being a carpenter, and carpentry is part of the worship. And that's just not so. I mean, you can look at Christianity and see that. And so it kind of translates over to Wicca in addition to that, in my opinion. Now, Mike Nichols, who you may know from writing all of those very excellent essays on the various Sabbaths, falls very solidly in the other side. He says you cannot be Wiccan without being a witch, without understanding all of the cycles of nature and being able to do those skills. And being a witch means that you are Wiccan, because Wicca is, the name Wicca means wise one, and the people that practice those skill sets typically tended to be the elders of the village who would come out and practice those types of skills for their members, to which I counter generally. Yeah, the wise people that had the knowledge of how to birth children were seen as wise people because there weren't any hospitals. And so, you know, the people that came out to help you give birth, you know, were the wise people, and they were called that. And so, yes, they could be called Wiccans, and then you get into back and forth and semantics and everything, and it gets to be one of those things that is no real resolution. It's just however you choose to see that element. And I choose to see it as that all Wiccans are not witches, because witchcraft is a skill set. Okay. One of the disadvantages, big disadvantages in Wicca itself, is that it can be very cliquish. Now, this is true of any group. It seems especially bad in Wicca. The reason being is the way Wicca is structured, Okay, you have a coven. It has a high priestess. It has a high priest. They are together. They are celebrating the deities. You have 11 other practitioners that are there. Okay. Eventually, more practitioners come into the circle, and you're starting to get up to 15 to 18 people. Okay. Well, at that point, there's a procedure called hiving off, where a portion of the oversized coven will go and make their own coven in their own area and get their own high priest and priestess, and they will worship as a group, and the original group will with reduced numbers will worship as their group. The only authority is that the second coven, the one that that hived off, has a lineage back to the first coven. Okay, the original coven, their high priest and priestess has no authority in the coven that hived off, except in that they know they've been in existence longer. Okay, so there's a respect for the time that the original coven was around, and there's a respect for their knowledge, but the high priestess of the first coven can't order anybody in the second coven to do anything. The covens are autonomous, okay? So what you wind up with is a syndrome called the high priestess syndrome, in which the leaders of the coven, and it does happen to the priests as well, it just tends to happen to the priestesses more often because they're put more in a higher position of authority. Usually the high priest is subservient to the high priestess, although that is changing in modern times. The leader of the coven will like some people more than others and will do things more for them, give them more knowledge, give them more teaching, better spells or whatever, and leave some of the rest of the not as well liked people in the background. And the priestess in question or the priest in question will start claiming ultimate authority and ultimate knowledge. They will start claiming to have a direct pipeline to the deities, and they will pretty much get really, really arrogant and start making pronouncements for people that just shouldn't be made. In my opinion, from what I've observed, this is directly because the person in charge in question is not as mature as they could be. They may have an amazing amount of knowledge in the craft of the witches. They may have a lot of understanding of the ceremonies and the deities, and may have all kinds of knowledge like that, but they apparently they're less mature in the interactions between people and in positions of authority. And so it kind of gets toxic after a little bit. This is one of those situations where it's okay to say, that's enough, I'm out of here. Because you're talking about taking care of your personal psyche. I was trying to pull up my copy of the Seeker's Bill of Rights, and apparently I can't get to my own website now. Error establishing a database connection. Interesting. Okay, so we'll try to fall back and punt.
Google.
So let's see. Yeah, maybe. Ooh, database name need to be repaired.
Great.
Yeah, nice. Excellent. What, Boots? No, I'm not feeding you again. All right, I've got a copy of it somewhere on my local hard drive, so I'm just going to have to find that, and that's going to take me a little bit.
Which is okay, we'll just vamp.
Technology hates us tonight.
This week. Okay, so I guess something that I kind of want to point out, because it was on my mind as we were talking about covens, Joy kept referring to the number 13, and that's a very traditional number of people for a coven. You can see references to, I think it's in King James's Demonology, maybe, that talks about it first, but different books will talk about the sort of very traditional number of 13. Now, it's kind of a common number and theme through different groups. And the reason behind that sort of depends on who you ask. But the way I kind of see it, it can be associated with the whole concept of Jesus and the 12 apostles. It could be the sun and the 12 signs of the zodiac. It could be the 13 moons of the year kind of thing.
Which is what it's most likely associated with, at least in Wicca, is the 13 moons of the year.
Well, I kind of wonder about that because of the sources that they draw on for their, you know, original collection of work. I mean, the Theosophists probably would have associated it with the sun and the zodiac signs. And, you know, I mean, it's a moot point. It doesn't even really matter. It's just kind of something to ponder. You know, if you happen to, you know, get into a Wicca 101 class or something with the idea of joining a coven, perhaps pose the question to your teacher. It would be interesting to sort of hear other opinions about it.
Okay. I got my copy of what I was looking for. Okay, back to the toxic covens and the bad situations. While Mary and I were out in Texas, there was a situation that became a huge problem. It was a couple covens that were doing and fighting with each other. This priestess didn't like that priestess and thought that she was getting above her station and back and forth. And it became really, really a bad situation, and it dragged the whole community down. A response to this after everything had settled was that there was a gentleman by the name of Charles Mars who wrote up what's called the Seeker's Bill of Rights. It's an outstanding declaration, basically, of what you have as a new Wiccan or someone who's just seeking the information and the rights that you should expect to have simply because you're breeding. the first one is the right to verify credentials. Okay, if somebody is a teacher or a priestess or a priest is telling you that they got this degree from here and that degree from there, you have the right to go to those places and try to find out, you know, if they actually did or not. People will try to BS you all the time and say that they got degrees if they didn't. I know of one guy who claims to have initiations into six different versions of Wicca and to be a high priest in each and every one of them with, you know, and understanding the fact that it takes multiple years to get a high priest degree in any one version of Wicca. The guy would have to be like 70 years old and been learning since birth in order to have it. In those traditions. So you have the right to, you know, call up the teachers of the person that's trying to teach you and go, hi, look, tell me about this person and tell me about the degrees that they got and how they did and if they know their information. You have the right to anonymity, okay? One of the big things in Wicca and paganism in general, but Wicca in specific, is that it's seen as something that is evil by the vast majority of non-Wiccans and non-pagans. I know according to Native American beliefs, the term witch is an evil spellcaster. And no matter how you try to explain it, if you say witch, they will associate it with an evil spellcaster, period. So there's a lot of misinformation still out there about Wicca and witchcraft. And you have the right to be secure in what you practice and not have anybody out you without your knowledge and without your consent. Okay. The reason this came by is the one of the people in that group that I was talking about before was in the broom closet, was not talking in public about their beliefs, and somebody got called his boss and told them that he was Wiccan, and he got fired. And lost, you know, his income and everything like that, and it really screwed up his life. Another example is that there was in Illinois a divorce case where there was a gentleman and a lady who were both Wiccans who were raising their child as Wiccan, as a witch, who were going through a divorce in a very conservative judge's court. He, you know, was doing the divorce decree, and because they were sending their child to the best private education that they could afford in the area, which happened to be a Catholic school, that in the divorce decree, the judge said that they could not practice Wicca around the child, ever, because it would confuse the child. Now, the child's being raised as Wiccan. She's, you know, familiar with Wicca and witchcraft, and suddenly mommy and daddy can't have a Yule celebration with her anymore because the judge did not understand that, you know, this is, it's fine to be having to have a alternate religion. As far as I know, the decision got overturned after a while, but it was a big stink for a long time. Okay. Point number three is you have the right to financial stability. This means that you have a right to keep your money in your pocket, okay? You should not ever, by anyone, be coerced into paying for the things in the coven. You shouldn't have to buy the high priestess's robe. You shouldn't have to buy the silver goblet. You shouldn't have to sacrifice heirlooms of your own for the group unless you want to. I mean, you can donate anything you want, but you shouldn't be coerced into it. You shouldn't be forced to. You shouldn't be told that, you know, the gods will look down upon you if you do not do this. That's bull. You know, the gods are going to love you anyway, and you shouldn't be forced to tithe, essentially, if you don't want to. And you shouldn't ever, ever be made to put yourself into financial jeopardy for somebody else, okay? As part of that, you have the right to compensation for professional goods and services, okay? If you are practicing a profession on behalf of the coven, or behalf of members of the coven, you have a right to get paid for that. Now, it's up to you whether or not you charge them for the labor or if you give them a discount. But if you're laying out money for materials, you should have a right to get the money back for those materials. Mary and I, one of the situations we found ourselves in is we had to get our locks changed at one point on our apartment. And there was a locksmith in the community who, you know, was a pretty good one. And we went to him and we said, hey, we need the locks changed. He came out, he changed out the locks, he, you know, did a good job with it, he gave us the new keys, and it was, you know, we paid him for his time and his labor. Now, he could have given as a sacrifice to the community the labor, the work to actually put the locks in, but he, you know, he has a right to eat himself, but he absolutely has a right to get the money back for the locks that he, you know, went out and paid for out of his pocket. You know, anything else is stealing. And as part of stealing, you have the right to sexual freedom. Okay. Now, let's be honest, everybody. Rape is rape and rape is rape. Okay. You should never, ever be coerced into having sex with somebody that you don't want to. And you should never, ever be coerced into having sex in public. Anything else, anything besides full cooperation from you is rape, okay? And it's theft of your sexual self,
liberty,
and your mental well-being and your liberty, okay? Which is why I kind of equated it with theft. it's, you know, it's, there are, as a slight digression here, there are groups that are very into the sexual mysteries, okay? Tantra is just one of them that I can think of right off the top of my head.
It's the most common one.
They use sex in a sacred and holy version, okay, way. If your version of Wicca that you have decided to join does that, more power to them, okay? But if there's a skeevy priest in the group that you absolutely do not feel comfortable getting naked around, don't. You should not be forced into doing that. And if somebody tries to force you into having sex with them, even if it's an orgy every other day, then you need to leave. If you're uncomfortable with it.
And that goes for the high priestess, too. I mean, if you're being forced as a man to have sex with the high priestess as some mandatory thing that you're feeling uncomfortable with, it's still rape, regardless.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt. And you need to get out of there because, I mean, it's an unhealthy situation. Doing it is not going to please anybody except the person that's forcing you into it. The charge of the goddess says all acts of love are in worship of me. Well, if you're being forced into it, that's not love. Okay, that's sexual dominance, and that's not a ritual to them. So, you know, get the hell out. As part of that, you also have the right to physical well-being, okay? To be honest, there's a lot of elements of Wicca that can be related into BDSM. There is a means of doing sensory deprivation where you're tied up and you're blindfolded and everything, and that's a dangerous, you know, thing. You have to have a lot of trust to do it. In the initiation, as part of the ritual of initiation, where you go from being a mundane to being a witch, you're reborn. Well, part of the rebirth ceremony is you're tied with cords that are wrapped around your neck. You're blindfolded. You are left naked and helpless in a remote area. And you're expected to get out of it, and that is your into a new place. Well, you have an absolute right that if you feel that you are in danger, that you can get out. I mean, if the cords are wrapped too tightly around your neck, you could choke to death, and it's not unheard of. Typically, in this initiation rite, they're loose enough that a couple of jerks and you're out of them. You can get out of them, or somebody's right there with you to help you get out of them. But, you know, safety first. Unfortunately, you can't safe word out of an initiation.
I was just thinking that. That's hilarious. Yeah, I mean, find out before you get involved if the coven you're trying to join uses bondage or scourging or any of those kind of things. If you have discomfort surrounding those, make sure you're aware of that before you get involved, because it's not going to lessen your discomfort if it's made a sacred event. But at the same time, keep in mind too that when you're in the process of learning anything like these, you know, various mysteries and anything esoteric, there's always a price to pay. And sometimes that means that you are placed in a position of submission to an authority, but it has to be a consensual submission. It cannot be like mandatory.
Right. And a lot of these rituals are set up so that you are put in a deliberately discomforting situation. Okay. Because anytime you have, you're learning something, you have to pay for it eventually, that information and that learning. And part of it is that it may be an uncomfortable thing that you're going through, and that's okay. It could be that the lesson is trust your fellow Wiccans in the group, and that's part of the reason that you're like that. But if you are getting triggered by having cords wrapped around your wrists, then you need to tell somebody that, and you need to, and you have the absolute right to say, okay, this is it. I'm not doing this. Can we do this some other way? Because there are other ways to do the same thing without the parts that are making you uncomfortable, okay? As a part of that also is you have the right to abide by the law. One of the covens that Mary and I saw while we were in Texas in the genesis of this document was very into using drugs as a way to touch the divine. They were using it as a crutch in a lot of ways to get into the ritual mindset and the holy mindset, except they weren't doing it right. I mean, it's one thing to use a little weed, but when you're using crack and cocaine and heroin to do the same thing, then you've got a hell of a problem, okay? And to be told that this is just the way it is and that if you want to worship with them, you have to do this, you need to get out because that's not the way, okay? Yes, there are some groups that use drugs as part of their worship service, okay? There are members of Native American tribes that use peyote. There are shamans down in Peru who snort this cactus liquor into their sinuses. There are others that will use elements or use some psychoactive substances to help get over the initial uncomfortableness and into a mindset where an altered state of consciousness, like we were talking about in one of the other shows. And that's fine, but it should never, ever be required, and it should never, ever be a substance that will have you get locked up, okay? It shouldn't ever be anything that shows up on a drug screen and gets you fired.
Well, to be fair, though, I mean, weed is an illegal drug, and if
not everywhere,
you're using that's true. Some states have come to their senses. There are laws in Canada that won't like have you locked up right away for having a little weed, but you know, it's still questionable. It's in a gray area right now, But
yeah, and there are laws on the books that if you can prove that it's for religious use and religious use only, you can use weed and like the psychedelics and things like that. A lot of Native American groups have gotten that added to them.
Well, yes, there are Native American churches who have like legal right to use peyote and stuff, whereas the use of, I want to call it mescaline for some reason. The derivative from peyote, LSD, maybe, is illegal for other people.
Psilocybin or something like that.
Psilocybin. Are they really? Interesting. And it occurs to me too, I'm kind of fond of these things, but in Northern traditions, in Northern European and North American, I think, traditions, the fly agaric or Amanita muscaria mushroom plays a very important role in shamanic work. So, you know, different areas have different psychedelic drugs, and sometimes they're illegal. Sometimes, as in the case of Salvia divinorum, they're basically like, it's a plant, you know, what harm is it going to do? So if you want to be part of a group that's going to use psychedelics, there are legal ones and there are illegal ones. And there are always like ways to find out the options that are not going to get you locked up.
Right.
Salvia divinorum, apparently.
Yeah. Basically, with that, I mean, you shouldn't be compelled into doing any illegal act. If the drugs that the coven is using are, you know, demonstrably illegal, and they are ones that are going to get you locked up, then, you know, you have a right to not use them and to insist on not using them. And if they try to force you to do it, you leave. If they're trying to convince you that theft is a way of worshiping the thief god and that you have to go shoplift stuff, tell them to take a hike, you know. You don't have
That's
to break
true.
The law in order to worship the gods, all right?
Well, and I think one of the important things, right. too, is that to remember that if there's a group that you're trying to join who insists on using drugs that are proven to be severely addictive, you might want to get away from them as fast as you can run, because they might just be using that as a way to keep you dependent on the group.
Right.
All legal matters aside, the mere fact that they would control a source of addiction for you would mean they would have full control of your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been done before, okay? So that's another one of those big red flags that you need to watch out for. Here's another one that a lot of people don't think about. You have the right to consistency, okay? If the sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, if it's wrong for somebody to do – one person to do something, it's wrong for everybody to do it. If it's wrong for you to skip a meeting, then and you get punished for it or disciplined for it, and somebody else skips every other meeting, then they should be being disciplined for it as well. Okay, inconsistency in the beliefs, inconsistency in the way the leadership treats you, all of those are something that you want to watch out for, because it shows that you have a leadership that is falling into they're my friend and you're not, cliquish type thing, okay? You also have the right to leave on your own conscience and not come back, okay? If they're following you, if they're trying to force you back into the group, if they're trying to guilt you into the group, if they're trying to blackmail you back into the group, if they're emotionally trying to get you to do things that they want you to do, and not leave, that's a cult. And that's a toxic coven. You need to get the hell out.
Okay? Basically, the joke I make with this situation is Wicca is not Scientology. So don't feel that any sort of manipulative tactics they use to try and keep you in the group are a good thing. I mean, there's no group you can join that if you're going to develop spiritually should use any sort of manipulation or blackmail or any kind of coercion to keep you in there.
Yeah. If they're having to force you to stay, then is that really someplace you want to be at? I mean, there's fanatic beliefs and there's, you know, the basic, simple, yes, we're all in this together, but, you know, you didn't sign away your life when you got initiated. Go ahead.
Sorry, it brings to mind the Mormons as well. I mean, theirs is an all-or-nothing policy. If you bail on the Mormon church after you've joined or grew up in it, you lose everything. And I think the Jehovah's Witnesses do the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a matter of all-or-nothing.
I don't know about the Jehovah's Witnesses. Yeah, I don't know about the JWs, but I can speak from experience with the Mormons. Yeah, they put a lot of pressure on you to come back to the group and to be the happy Mormon with everybody else because of somebody. They're very vested in the fact that Mormonism is the greatest thing on earth in the history of it. And if somebody is dissatisfied with it and leaves, then that sort of proves them wrong. So they use your family against you, they use your finances against you, they use your job against you, because a lot of people are employed by Mormon bosses, and, you know, suddenly they have poor performance at work, and they lose their job. So, anyway, and you have the right to be at peace with one's conscience, okay? If there's something going on that your conscience is saying is wrong and needs to change and the conclusion that you come to is that you need to leave or that you need to do this, you have a perfect right to do that. And if somebody tries telling you, no, you're wrong, the gods are saying this actually, that's another thing that you need to look at as another red flag, okay? Wicca in its entirety is about your relationship with your deities, okay? It's not about being a member of a group. It's not about being part of a super secret cult. It's not part of being with the cool kids in the lunchroom, okay? It is your relationship with your gods, all right? And that is one of the things that I think a lot of people tend to forget. In the mad dash to be an associate with somebody, to be in a community, okay, a lot of people are come into Wicca and come into witchcraft because they're missing some element in their life, and a lot of times it's a group of friends that will stand by you, and it's a family. Okay, we moved away from the extended family. We even moved away from the nuclear family into the solitary person in our society in general. And people want to belong to a group. They find Wicca. They find a whole bunch of people that, you know, look to be happy. They're friends that talk, that worship together, that understand what's going on in each other's lives, that are concerned about each other, and they want to be part of that. So they jump into it with both feet without realizing that, you know, that may not be the greatest thing for them, okay? So, and, you know, after a little while, it's really hard to go, okay, I made a mistake and I want to go on to someplace else. Because community is there, and the community is private, it's hard to sever those ties. So understand that at its root, Wicca and any religion is ultimately about you and your religious expression with your deities and with your interpretation of the divine, okay? And forget everything else. Yeah, it's nice to have friends, but, you know, when you're going through a major crisis of conscience, who do you turn to normally? You turn to your deities, you turn to your mom, and things like that, okay? So, let's see, we've got about 25 minutes left, and we're going to talk about the dichotomy of solitary versus coven, okay? In Wicca, you can be a solitary practitioner. Okay, you can read the books, you can surf the internet, you can get the information from the various places, and you can practice in your own bedroom, or you can get together with a whole bunch of other people and do the songs and the chants and the dancing around and everything like that and have a community religion. Okay, what people tend to forget is that the solitary path is just as valid as the coven path, okay? A lot of people that are in covens tend to look down on the solitaries. A lot of solitaries feel like they're missing something from the coven by not being part of a coven, okay? And what they're missing is the socialization. Everything else, the liturgy, the rituals, the communing with the gods, the doing the magic, the learning the information, all of that is exactly the same, okay? The only thing that's different is the community. So we're going to look at the two. When you're in a coven, you do have a community of people around you that have different ideas and different thoughts on the not only the practice of witchcraft, but also the knowledge and skills that go into it. One person may be a heck of a poet and be able to write beautiful poetry for the rituals and in celebration of the deities. Somebody else might know more about getting people into altered states of consciousness during the ritual. Somebody else may be able to channel the deities very easily so that they can talk directly to you through the priestess's mouth or whatever, okay? And that's wonderful in that there's such a diverse, you know, group of people who can do different things. When you're a solitary, unfortunately, you have to do it all on your own, okay? You have to constantly question yourself almost as to whether or not something's happening and do your own reality checks and learn how to do that because, you know, the voices in your head of the gods are going to sound exactly like the voices in your head telling you to stick your foot out the car while it's moving. And you have to really learn to be able to discriminate between what is the deities talking to you and what is your own brain trying to kill you. And it's hard. It takes a lot of time and it takes a long amount of time. The initiation, where you learn the mysteries of not only the deities' names, but some of the information that's not shared in public, the way the universe works together, how time is for a big ball of timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff, like the doctor says. You can be given that and told that in the circle by the priestess. Solitaries, I think, have an advantage in this in that once they learn it directly from the deities, and once you learn it, you pretty much never forget it. Because of the way you learn it. It's very, very in your face, very immediate, and very visceral when you do learn it. You don't have, as a solitary, the problems with high priestess syndrome because you're by yourself. You don't have the community support, however, because you're by yourself. You don't have, when you're a solitary, you have to become an expert at everything, whereas you may go to this coven member who does tarot readings for a reading for your future, and you may pick up this herbal blend from another coven member who caught it in their still room, and they're, you know, it's for your cough or whatever. As a solitary, you would have to learn to do your own divinations and how to make your own herbs and how to, you know, write your own books and, you know, do your own book binding with the Book of Shadows or change your own locks out because you don't have the other people there that are also, you know, part of the group who have the skills that are different from you. Of course, you're not having to give your skills away either. So, you know, that's another one of those. It's good and it's bad at the same time.
Incidentally, if you're looking for a tarot reading and you don't happen to be a reader yourself, Joy is one.
Hi, yeah. We did Tarot Talk for 16 episodes, and I was the one that did most of the talking for that. Brian wound up asking questions. But, yeah, I do professional tarot readings. You can go to my site. It's linked off of magicalmusings.net, and you can get a tarot reading. I think I charge fairly reasonable rates. The going rate is $1 a minute, so I'm about half that. So, anyway, there's your ad for the evening.
I figured since we are talking about, you know, reaching out to others with skills, you might as well bring it up.
Yeah. And with a solitary group, yeah, understand something. Even if you're solitary in your practice and you sit alone in your bedroom, on your bed, and you do the meditation, you do the full moon espit, and you celebrate Beltane by yourself with the help of some appliances or something, you can still be part of the community online. There are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of groups out there who have forums, who swap teachings, who can talk with you. They have their own specialties. They have their own information. They can, you know, substitute for a coven that's right there, okay? They won't be able to help you come over at 3 in the morning and help you drain your waterbed because it burst, but, you know, they'll be able to help you with a medicine and mail it to you or something, you know. So that's another thing that you can take a look at. I want to talk now about sources of information. And books are one of those really big, good sources of information, as long as you're getting good books, okay? What Brian and I came up with at this point is books not to listen to because they tend to be bad and they tend to be big newbie sucks, if you will. And by that, what I mean is that they're the ones that are pushed when you go into a metaphysical store or into a Barnes & Noble and you're looking for information on Wicca. You'll wind up finding these books. You'll find them advertised. You'll find them displayed very prominently. And you'll think they're a good book, and they're just not. Amongst these is the Silver Raven Wolf books. Okay, as a class, I have found very few of her books that are actually decent. Mostly what she does is she panders to people that are teenagers and below. She flatters them and then tells them that they're special snowflakes and that they only have to reach out and embrace their destiny and they'll be better than their parents were, and that it's okay to not tell your parents everything that you're doing and to hide all of your ritual implements and to, oh, the female carving that's up on my wall is just an angel. It's not a goddess or anything. Oh, I'm not into that pagan Wiccan stuff. No, I don't know what you're talking about. Parents just don't understand. And this is actual stuff right out of her books. And it really disturbs me as not only a practitioner of Wicca, but as a parent. If you're having to lie about your religion, then something's really wrong. Because you should never have to lie about your religion. You should never have to deny it. Okay? The gods and the people and those around us and those that love us are not going to be upset by coming out and saying, okay, this is me. This is what I believe. And this is what I'm exploring right now. Because it's your spirituality. Okay, if you're having your parents, no, I'm not really a Wiccan, then you need to reevaluate why you're being Wiccan. Is it for shock value or is it an actual spiritual journey? And if you have to tell them that, you need to try to figure out why you feel that you have to. And if it's because they won't understand, then educate them. If it's because they'll hate you, then you need to, you know, sit down and talk to them about it and deal with it on a very straightforward basis like that, okay? It's never a good thing to lie and to deny your own deities, okay? You wouldn't expect a Christian to do that these days. You shouldn't have to do it either. Along with the special snowflake syndrome, there's the Gray School of Witchcraft that Oberon Zell started with his book, The Apprentice Wizard's Guide to Wizardry. It came out during the Harry Potter craze, and while the book itself has some information in it that's good, most of the information in it is horrendous. When you put a passage in your book that says that snakes came from eyeless lizards that had migrated underground, lost their legs and lost their eyes, and then when they came back up above ground, redeveloped eyes, and that's where snakes come from. And there is literally a fuck ton of information, biological information, that says, no, you're wrong, then you got to look at the source and go, well, wait a second, okay? Now, I'm not saying that the people involved in this are bad, okay, or that they're trying to spread misinformation. What they're trying to do, and it's a laudable goal, is they're trying to add the dialogue of mythology, of common pop culture mythology that we have now, into a magical context and redefine some of the things that we class as fantasy into it could be possible. Okay. For instance, one of the things that was included was an interview from Gene Roddenberry calling him the greatest wizard alive because he created Star Trek. And when you look at everything that came out of Star Trek, not just the TV shows, the flip phones that we had, the cell phones, communicators, the rocketry science, and you actually look at the real science that's behind Star Trek, I've been told by an actual physicist that the science that they showed in Star Trek is actually solid, that they grasp at some straws and they extend out the physics and the science, and the fiction parts are still fiction. But where they actually say, this is this and this is this, they're right, because you can go back and prove it scientifically. And it's incredible, because he was, you know, decades before his time. And, you know, you talk about peace and love and the movements for getting rid of racism and the thoughts that we could in the future, you know, be all one planet of humans, not a whole scattered disassociative groups of the Christians over here and the Muslims over there and the blacks there and the Chinese here and the whites over there. You know, when you start talking about everybody can be equal to each other and there's a true egalitarianism, that was a radical concept in 68, 69, and 70.
Well, and I think too,
best.
One of those really interesting concepts they sort of promoted in the Star Trek series, in the franchise, I suppose, was that as it basically became a resource-based economy where everything was just provided. It wasn't based on a monetary system. So, you know, there wasn't that dependence on, you know, money and hierarchy and that sort of thing. So that's where this idea of intergalactic harmony comes in and the advancement of, you know, groups and so on. So I think that's where the Venus Project is kind of trying to hop in. But
but that's a radical concept when you're talking about it in 68 and the economic collapse, you know, right around that time, and JFK is getting shot and the stock market tanks and, you know, everything like that. So, you know, saying that there's this classless society where everybody has what they need, and if they want something additional, all they have to do is go and ask for it or find it, and everybody's like, okay, you know, okay, so you got some gold. Good for you, you know. And that's, you know, a huge thing. So, yeah, Roddenberry was a hell of a magician in that. The book that came out says that he was, you know, a wizard, and he did this deliberately, trying to change the cultural consciousness. And I've read interviews with Gene Roddenberry, and he was in awe of how much his wagon train in space touched people and how much they latched onto it. And he said, you know, very distinctly quite a number of times, look, I did this because I needed to pay my bills. And it was a concept that I had for a little while, and I'm glad everybody loves it, but I wasn't trying to change society. I was trying to keep a roof over my head. And so, you know, it gets a little squirrely when you get odd declarations like that going into something that is targeted at teens who have trust of adults and people in authority and who are not prone to going and looking up facts on their own, okay? Because, I mean, let's face it, they've got school. They're in there, you know, 10 hours a day, 8 hours a day, however long. And then they come home and they have homework, and they're not going to the School of Witchcraft and Wizardry and read a fact like that and then go search for it on the internet. They're going to say, oh, okay, well, this guy who's been doing this for 60 years said it, and therefore it's true. Okay? Silver Ravenwolf says to tell my parents that I'm going to the mall with my friends instead of going down and doing a ritual in the woods. You know? And it's that circumvention of parental authority and the declarations that they're all special snowflakes, just like everyone else, that I tend to start getting really mad about. Another one is 21 Lessons of Merlin, for many of the same reasons. He lies constantly in that book, and there are a number of reviews that say that it's a horrid book and it has nothing to do with druidry, and it has very little to do with druidry and Wicca, simply because it's so scattered. Okay, there's another book out there by Anne Moira talking about the history of Wicca, or the history of witchcraft, in which she states that there were papal elections and that they elected a woman and they elected a horse, which are very, very interesting because when you go back and look at all the papal elections, no, there isn't. When you look at, and then she says that the way they practice Wicca now is exactly how the Indus practiced Wicca in 10,000 BCE. You go, what the fuck? Because, like we said, you know, game of telephone, can't pass it down word of mouth. And she's a history professor and coming out with this stuff. And I'm like, what? And, you know, I think it's a waste of trees personally. So use a little bit of the discretion that you have and research not only the books that you're buying, and look at the reviews for them and go to other websites and see what other people are saying about them, not what the publishers are saying about them, not what Amazon is saying about them, but independent people who read the books and what they think about having read the book. And then, you know, take anything that you read with a grain of salt, because I can put anything down on paper and I can pronounce it in these podcasts, you know, with absolute authority, but I could very easily be wrong. And believe me, Mary calls me on it constantly.
Well, I think part of the whole idea too is that once you get some experience under your belt, you can kind of determine for yourself what is bullshit and what isn't. So after a while, I mean, there's a certain, you know, collection of authors that I would really recommend for new Wiccans or those curious about Wicca. Christopher Penzack comes to mind, and he's got a really great series called The Temple of Witchcraft. Fascinating books. There's like six of them or something like that, so it's kind of expensive to collect them, but
Cunningham, Buckland, those are people that I would recommend, just
definitely
with no reservation.
And I mean, once you get experience, don't be afraid to read the shitty books, because it helps you to sort of see what people around you are reading, you know, that you can steer clear of, because if you know why something sucks, you can tell them, well, you know, I read that one and they were totally wrong on this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And if you're looking to,
because I was going to do a class on it for Wicca at the UU Church not too long ago, and it was one of the worst books I'd ever seen in my life. And I knew why it was bad, because I was able to pick out the misinformation, the missing facts, and the incorrect stuff because of all the other reading that I'd done. And
mm-hmm.
so I would have been able to tell them, okay, here's what she's saying. Here's what actually is. And correct all of that information for them.
One of those really important things, too, we only have like 2 minutes left, but really important, don't be afraid to read the source material either. Read Dionne Fortune, read Margaret Murray, you know, read like Manly Hall, read books that existed outside the last 20 years, because there's a lot of information you will glean from those that is relevant, or that you'll be able to say, well, such and such an author drew from that predominantly, etc. So don't be afraid to read those like authors.
Yep.
Some of them are interesting too. So
we only have a few seconds left, so thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. Hopefully there's no other glitches with this. So maybe
true.
This one actually worked tonight. Tune in. There's not going to be a show next week because it's Thanksgiving in Canada and in the United States. So we're going to skip that week, and we're going to come back on the 4th. On the 5th with a show on Asatru with author Galina Krasikova, author of The Northern Tradition and several other books. She's going to be a guest speaker, and we're going to have her on.
So, yes, thank you for joining us tonight. We'll be back to our regular Thursday shows. This was just a fluke. Have a good one.
Yeah, this is screw them. Talk to y'all later. Bye.
Bye-bye, folks.